You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
This is The Brian Callen Show with my colleague, Hunter Motz, and we have Dr. Keltner, Professor Dr. Keltner, a name his parents made up. He's not, you know, it's not like he's from Dutch lineage or anything. He's just Dr. Keltner. And he's a professor at UC Berkeley in psychology. And Hunter and I read a great article of yours sort of in response to Robert Greene's The 48 Laws of Power. Yeah. Which we had talked about anyway. You know, it was very Machiavellian. And if you look at one of the things I thought was interesting about and I want to talk to you about is there's this idea, I suppose, that, you know, well, power, the relationship of power over people and Machiavelli, you know, was the great political strategist. And this is how you keep control people. But we probably know that, in fact, that's not the way to solve the political problem. It's really not the way to create productive, innovative people.
And it's also not how power really works, right?
It's not how power really works. And that's what we really appreciated about your article. It was such a great rebuttal to, because the first thing I asked Robert Greene is, I said, is this the manual for a sociopath? You know, and he was like, no. And we had a conversation. We had a great time with him. And
yeah, I mean, his point was is that this is the manual specifically for people who aren't sociopaths so they can understand sociopaths.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay.
So tell us about the article. Tell us about your research. Tell us about the Greater Good Science Center.
Sure. So, you know, about 20 years ago, I got interested in the science of power. And like a lot of people, and like Robert Greene very intelligently reviews, I was started from kind of an assumption that power is Machiavellian, that it's really about coercion and manipulation and domination. And, you know, the 25 years of science on this really suggests something really different that, you know, just to start with, you know, we can differentiate the different kinds of power. Right. So, you know, Machiavelli writing in 16th century Italy in really one of the most violent times in human history was writing about power as it really applies within a very violent society. And it really is about, you know, striking first, being deceptive, being aggressive and coercive. And obviously we live in a much different era than that which Machiavelli lived. So I really like Hannah Arendt's definition of power, which is power is really your capacity to stir the social collective. It's your ability to kind of move social networks, right, and produce social change. And then, you know, so that got me rolling. And what I've been interested in, Brian, for, you know, with a lot of other labs is how do we get power, right? Does the Machiavellian philosophy work? And then what's it do to us, right? And there we see all kinds of craziness. So it's been an interesting adventure.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you're talking, I've read some of your research on what power does to us. And it's really about just how the degree to which absolute power or really any sort of power does corrupt us.
That's Hunter Motz, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another made-up name. Docker, Letner, and...
Docker and Hunter.
Docker and Hunter. What is this podcast?
It sounds like an utterly terrible 80s cartoon. Docker and Hunter.
Docker and Hunter.
It'd be an independent film. I
mean. Yeah, exactly. Two smart guys talk about power.
Bill and Ted's for people who like ideas.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah
but
so, you know, so what we suggested, and this, you know, goes back a long time, and people have been worried about what power does to us since people have been forming societies, right? And what we have found, and there are literally, you know, 1,000 studies on this, is that, and we cast it really simply, which is that power kind of turns on the go switch in your brain and in your nervous system, and it just makes you go after whatever you want, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, studies find that high power people flirt more directly. They touch people more. They enjoy things more. They are more likely to engage in sexual affairs. They're more likely to get caught shoplifting. They're more likely to take resources.
Wow!
And in one of our studies, we found, you know, it's kind of this funny study where we brought three people to the lab, they did this really boring task by design. One of the three people had power. In the 30 minutes into the study, we put down a plate of five delicious smelling chocolate chip cookies. Everybody took one cookie. All groups always left one cookie on the plate. So the key question, who ate that fourth cookie? High power people.
Yeah.
But not only did they grab that cookie rather arrogantly, but my students coded how they ate, and they're more likely to eat with their mouths open, lips smacking, crumbs falling on their shirts. So it just kind of makes us impulsive.
Yeah. Now, does that correlate, though, with do you think people that want power and go after power, do you find that that is a personality type? Are you more likely to be a sociopath if you're that way? Have you done any research on that?
Well, you know, it's a little bit different, and I think that the popular culture would love to believe that psychopaths and sociopaths want power, mm-hmm. right? And that they get power and they're running the country. And I think that the data really suggests something different, which is, to your question, Brian, the people who kind of gravitate to positions of power, and there are over 70 studies on this in business context, military context, school grounds, middle school politics.
Oh, yeah, because I was going to ask you, you know, generals and CEOs, and you hear a lot of people saying most of them are sociopaths, one in four and all that stuff.
Right. So the truth is that the person who kind of gets power intuitively is first and foremost somebody who's has a lot of social energy and is a hyper connector, right? Mm-hmm. And you just, it time and time again, this is, you know, if I put a bunch of people on a desert island, it's kind of the high social energy person who reaches out to people, talks a lot, makes jokes, touches people, brings people together. That person gets power, right?
Yeah. You mean They're Brian Callen.
Yeah. You mean Brian, you mean me? Yeah. Yeah. I've been accused of that. I'm definitely not a sociopath.
But you are a toucher, and
I'm
you
a toucher
are
and a flirter.
A flirter and a joker.
And a fucker.
Yeah.
What?
No, you did yeah. what?
Wait
yeah.
a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, women get power when they flirt a lot. That's findings by my colleague, Laura Cray. So, it's this person with a lot of social energy. And then importantly, like you get power, there are different strategies that apply to different contexts. So if you're in the business world, your ability to be really open and creative gets you power.
Right.
If you're in the military, your real discipline focus, right? Your ability to like follow the rules and kind of know the procedures gets you power. If you're in school and parents care a lot about whether the kids are powerful or not, right?
Right.
It's the warm-hearted kid who gets power, believe it or not. It's really the kid who like intervenes when two people are fighting or a bullying episode. So, but that social energy is key. And I think the safer view, the sounder view, is power turns you into the sociopath. So we look at who has power and we forget what they were like as they got power.
Right. That's very interesting.
Well, and that's the interesting thing. When you look at a lot of these dictators, I mean, you know, there's who they are when they start off. And sometimes they have really good intentions. They really want to make a difference and all that sort of stuff. But then they start to build a harem. You know, they need one palace, they need two palaces, and they just really go down the deep end.
Yeah, I think there are certain. I think Saddam Hussein was clearly a sociopath. But for example,
But he was certainly
Castro.
Much
Castro, if you read his earlier, like who he was as a man earlier, he was not. He was a guy trying to solve a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's. It's a pretty in any biography you read on him is pretty flattering as a young man. He's a romantic poet warrior. You know,
is that right?
And we would
Gaddafi
have all,
was also the same
very
way.
Much so.
I mean, you know,
even to the end, Gaddafi, you know, it wasn't like Saddam had these purges and he would just kill everybody around him periodically.
Gaddafi had those purges.
Well, not really, actually.
My parents live in Libya, Brian, so no, but, I might know
but
things
I've
about
read,
Libya.
I've read lots of comparisons, and you're right in the sense that Gaddafi was caught up, I think, in, look, he wasn't a sweetheart, but he was caught up also in the way you did things, the way things were done.
I'll tell you
in
that
the Middle East,
there's, in
you know?
Libya, they say that there are two people in Libya. This was under Gaddafi's regime. There were those who had killed for Gaddafi and those who hadn't.
Oh.
So, I mean, I think that's
right.
The thing.
Well,
It's really, I mean, this is a really important point, and I think there's a certain amount of reflection on this right now in the thinking about power. You know, when you read this fellow Every's definitive history of Stalin and Hitler, right? And you expect to read about, you know, these sociopathic, you know, villainous murderers. And in point of fact, neither guy was that remarkable a person,
no,
right, as they rose in power. And what happened is they fell into remarkable circumstances.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then power turned them into...
Well, Hitler wanted to be, you know, an artist, didn't get into the Vienna School for the Arts, I think, because he couldn't draw human figures very well, which is interesting.
Or because the Jews kept him out.
Oh, well, that's what he said. Yeah, well, all those Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, you're right. I mean, and even Stalin, if you look at his earlier, he was kind of a party bureaucrat. He had been in a gang before that. Yeah.
People didn't think he was that bright. He was kind of inarticulate. Not that charismatic a speaker. Same with Hitler.
Yep.
But they power turned them into genocidal machines, given the context.
Right.
Well, there were at least some signs fairly early on that that was the way that Stalin was going to go. Wasn't there the legendary warning in Lenin's will, essentially, watch out for Comrade Stalin? He's a bad dude.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I liked the article, and I like what your perspective on the idea that, you know, it's really about innovation, and it's the way you get ahead in today's world, in the corporate world or anything, is the wonderful thing about technology is you might be a CEO of a big company, but there's some startup, some kid who's going to come up with a startup and a different way of doing things.
Yeah.
And he's going to create a product that everybody wants, and they don't want your product anymore. Yeah. And you better foster a culture of innovation and happy workers, because happy workers are more innovative than the others. So this whole Machiavellian idea of, you know, pitting people against each other just creates a climate of fear, and it does, it stifles creativity. It's what you said. I don't know who said it, but you can hold a gun to somebody's head, make them lift a box. You can't hold a gun to somebody's head and make them have a great idea.
Yeah,
Brian, I mean, when I started to do the science, and you know, Machiavelli, it is better to be feared than loved. Mm. Robert Greene, you know, you lead through deception and making sure everybody's paying attention to you and having them fear you, right? That's such a deep core conviction in our culture. And as I was doing this science, I thought, well, you know, do social scientists study Machiavellians? And it turns out there are, 75 to 100 studies of people who self-identify as Machiavellians, right? There's a scale that measures this. It has items like, I think, you know, everybody's out for their own good. You got to step on people to rise in power. It's okay to lie to get your way. And about 15% of the world is more Machiavellian. And there are great studies looking at how do they do at work. And they don't rise in power.
They don't. They get found out. They get found out. They're a-holes, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then not only that, but they feel more isolated at work,
mm-hmm.
likely to lie. And like you said, they win in positions of power. They lead in ways that dampen innovation. And actually, the people they lead don't trust the organization. They want to move on. So they do get found out.
Wouldn't you say human nature? I mean, have you done any studies on the idea that overall we all know what right conduct is? I mean, human beings know. Like, for example, if all your friends helped you and then you turn around and double cross all of them and get ahead, we all know. I think most societies would recognize that as being a bad thing. And there is something called right conduct. There is something called good conduct that I think all of us sort of feel is and I think, did you write a book
on
this?
Yeah, you wrote two books, Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and then The Compassionate Instinct, The Science of Human Goodness.
Look at that, ladies and gentlemen, Born to be Good. And so that's a good thing. That I'm reading the Screwtape Letters, and I'm now reading C.S. Lewis's book, A Mere Christianity. It's a great book. I'm not a Christian, but it's a great book on sort of, he starts with the idea of a moral sense of what human nature is. The nature of if you drop a stone, that's its nature is to fall because of the law of gravity. But the human law is something we often do things against our instinct. We keep our promises and we admit truth even though it makes us look the fool. We help somebody even though it might, you know, it's a life-threatening situation. So we oftentimes act against our nature, don't we? Against our instinct.
Or rather, our instinct is to be good.
Well, that's that. Yeah, there you go. So it seems that sometimes Machiavellian people, in many ways, would you say, might be violating core human laws, principles, sensibilities, instinct, right?
Well, you know, I think I agree, and I think that there's an explosion of interest right now in economics and evolution and sociology and psychology about what are those core instincts, right? And I think it's really interesting. In general, what we find is that people are much more cooperative than traditional models of human behavior would assume, that we, in general, across different cultures, will share about 40% of a resource. We'll intuitively cooperate with people and help them out, even at cost to the self. Lots of great new data on that. Little kids, as early as a year old, will, you know, just kind of reach out and help an adult that they don't know who needs help. So we have this tendency towards cooperation and also a tendency towards self-interest and competition. And those are always in conflict. But what we know is, to your sense of like, what is this moral sense that's at play in groups, that groups give power to people who show more cooperation, right? And people get really upset around the world when they find out that there are kind of free riders or people who are exploiting others, or the guy who, you know, says he helped out on the project, takes the money, but didn't help at all. Mm-hmm. And there are great new studies called altruistic punishment that show, like, I'll punish that Machiavellian, even if it costs me, and I take delight in it, right? So that tells us groups are really invested in
fair play.
What's that?
Fair play.
Exactly.
Look at the Boko Haram thing, you know. You know, you're not allowed to kidnap a bunch of innocent school children. You can't do it.
No way.
Yeah, I don't care what you stand for. They really screwed up, because now we're going to get Delta Force in there and the other African nations. And that was a big, gross miscalculation, because the whole world went, wait a minute, not only are you going to kidnap them, you're threatening to sell them into slavery, sexual slavery? Nah. Yeah. You just lost all your credibility. We're going to shoot you in the head. If you all die, everybody who's even a pacifist goes, if there's a raid and you guys all just end up dead, I'll sleep just fine that night, right? I mean, there is this strong sense of human beings have a, hold on. We're not Mongols anymore. Wondered how the Mongols, I read that Genghis Khan, in fact, had a crisis within his own community, because he was going and doing these terrible things, and these young men were doing this. These kids were coming in and learning how to kill and rape and all that. The problem was, when they got back to their camps, they were doing the same things to the women in front of them.
Exactly.
And he was like, this is a problem. They're like, why? I do it over here. Why can't I do it over here? Well, no, because they belong to us. Not a good enough reason. He needed to kind of invest in a philosophy that had some traction. Otherwise, he was going to have total chaos, a snake eating its own tail, right?
Yeah. No, and that was, you know, back to Machiavelli. I mean, when you study historically all the great biographies and histories of Machiavelli's time in Florence, I mean, it was a radically chaotic, violent time. And he was just grasping at some idea that would preserve a little stability of power. But today, we have historically built up these ideas of what it means to be a good citizen, right? That capitalize on our deep, evolved intuitions of, like, you don't hurt kids. Anybody who hurts kids like that, you know, people are very willing to, you know, violate their sense of no harm to protect that.
That's right.
That's right.
You know, it's really interesting too, Brian. We've been working on kind of what are the group-based ways in which we make sure Machiavellians don't run the show, right? And one of them is reputation, like the reputation you have at work, in a hospital, in your community. And the thing people care most about in terms of your reputation is not like, do you take drugs or do you have sex with people? But it's really, are you a good citizen, right? Are you trustworthy?
Are you kind?
Are you kind?
I'm getting feedback on your thing.
Oh, sorry.
No, I'm not anymore.
I found it at the table, so.
Oh, okay. but I think that's right. Are you kind is a huge thing. You know, they've done studies with men and women, and a man always looks for one of the things most men will not stand for in a mate. I don't know about women, but if a woman is not kind, that's a big issue.
Yep.
Certainly for me. I mean, you've got to be kind. If you hurt people's feelings, I got a big problem with that.
Yep.
There's the thing that I think is really interesting as well is if you look at who has really gravitated towards Robert Greene's book, I mean, prisoners and, you know, rap artists have really resonated
to it. Who've come from a crappy world.
Who've come from a crappy world. It's a lot like the world of 15th century Italy. And I think that's the interesting thing is that there are, you know, those worlds of chaos are Machiavellian.
Yeah. Or like you think about Soviet or you think about Russia and Putin in the KGB where there was no transparency of communication. You know, there were kind of Machiavellian means by which you could take people down. But, you know, if you read people like Robert Wright, who I really respect, and Steve Pinker, there is a sense that we're moving towards more civil societies.
Well, sure, and the better angels of our nature, Stephen Pinker's book. Yeah, about how fewer people have died violently in the 21st century than ever
in the 20th century. Yeah,
in the 20th century.
Yeah, and the rates of violence are way down, and as we move in that direction, the Machiavellian philosophy is
bankrupt.
It is.
I often think about that with Putin. You know. He's got to know in his heart, or maybe he doesn't because he doesn't expose himself to enough of these thoughts. But, you know, Russia doesn't they make their money off their resources, right? Their oil and stuff. But they don't produce a thing. I mean, when was the last time you bought a Russian car, a Russian computer, a Russian even
But that's
clothing?
The problem. From Putin's point of view, they don't. I mean, you know, that's the – if you're – being a dictator is great for you and terrible for all of your people. I mean, Barack Obama makes $200,000 a year or whatever it is. You know, Vladimir Putin, you know, Kim Jong-un.
Sure.
I mean, they make billions.
But the only way for Russia to even, like, gain some glory is, of course, to take over Crimea, you know, to annex the Ukraine. Well, congratulations. Dude, you know, I mean, welcome to the 21st century. You know, it's just
but that's the problem. They're not in the 21st century. I mean, you know,
they're not in the 21st
that's
century,
that's right. I mean, if you look at Russian culture, I mean, that's the problem is, you know, it's one thing to have a piece of paper that says, oh, we're a democracy now and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, it's the cultural environment. It's the beliefs. It's the level of trust.
But what I liked about the article, though, is that the Russian idea, and as men, you know, you got to be strong, you know, domination and strong. In fact, it's actually the weak way to go. It doesn't work. It actually doesn't really work.
Yeah.
Warrior energy, the idea of conquest and conquering and sowing fear and being on top, looking down on your minions is a horseshit way to do it because it doesn't work. It's actually the weaker way. It's not as effective.
It doesn't create innovation.
It doesn't create innovation. You're not going to be as strong.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to be a yoker wielding a sword in the middle of a field
while
they take you out with a
field.
Drone or something. You know, you know what I mean? Even hard power, military might. You know, our military technology is just unbelievable.
It's unprecedented,
and it comes from free enterprise. It comes from there's a profit motive. You've got very smart people coming up with ways to do these things.
And I have to say, you know, historians have written about how Machiavelli was obsessed with this force called animo, which is like machismo and violence, and you know, just throwing your weight around. And I think that the new conversations about what power really is in the 21st century, and your reference, Brian, to soft power, to the power of ideas, the power of the powerless, the power of innovation, is we're in it's a radically different world where, you know, a innovation like Facebook or Google has changed our society more. Right. Then the latest military innovation.
Sure. And with people like Steven Pinker and their work on brain science and stuff and learning how the brain works. And the more you understand that, the more you realize that the idea of normal, somebody who's normal, isn't really there's no such thing really anymore. I mean, I guess normal is going to become a bad word after a while. It's sort of like middle of the road. You're medium, you know.
Well, but I think the other thing too is, I mean, I think it's that we all are normal. I mean, overwhelmingly, what you're talking about in terms of sociopaths, right? These people don't necessarily start off as sociopaths. We're all starting off. I mean, more and more, I think we're finding the truth that all men are created equal. From a starting point, we're all more or less the same, but our brains are so flexible And
Pinker would have a. He wrote a book called The Blank Slate.
No, but that's two very different things. When Pinker talks about the blank slate, he's refuting the idea that there's nothing in play at the beginning.
Right.
There are things that are in play. If you give somebody a lot of power, they're going to become corrupt. There are built-in heuristics and switches, but within that sort of base human nature, we all have the power to become flexible within those constraints. So you're still going to have fear and love and hate and all of that sort of stuff and a capacity to learn language, but the brain is incredibly flexible.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, I hope part of this rethinking, and I love your discussions of the blank slate and, Pinker's broad historical view of the change in violence, but, I think this rethinking of what power really is, I think we need to move beyond these rather simplistic ideas like, it's the sociopathic guy who gets power, and think about the context too, right? That the people who act in sociopathic fashion, they have radically different backgrounds than what you or I grew up in.
Yes.
We should be mindful of that.
Yeah.
So.
And also though, it bears in mind too, that the fact that I think a lot of people, Richard Branson and Bill Gates and a lot of people who have a lot of money realize that they've got enough steaks to eat for a lifetime, and now they're trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot of, like, the hyper-rich are becoming way more altruistic probably than they ever have been.
I think so. I mean, I think that there are data suggesting some shifts too. And I think that the evidence is pretty clear. The last 20, 30 years, greed had this privilege in terms of it's okay to be greedy, greed is good, you think of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And now kind of the Google folks and the Facebook folks, there's this new ethos, right, think about using wealth for a different kind of social change.
Well, I know it's also because that's what people are really competing for. People are competing for dignity, respect, they're competing to be of value to the community. Like, everybody's trying to do something cooler that is more useful to the world.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Do you find that that's the case? It seems like corporations like Google and these they have ping pong tables and you can dress the way you want. I mean, it's just a very different thing. My father was a banker, and he would go to work every day in a starched white shirt, and and there was a protocol and a way you behaved, and even the way you spoke. There was corporate language, and it's very much not that way anymore.
Yeah. Do some work down at both those places, and it is a much different world. Younger engineer types, coming out of different cultures, right?
Yeah.
Non-traditional backgrounds, very playful.
Yeah. What is your work now? What are you doing now? Are you working on another book or?
Yeah, well, I'm working on a book on power and you've already nailed the thesis, which is
it's what we do here.
Yeah.
We ruined it. No need to read the book. We will. When is it coming out?
Probably 18 months.
Good.
Like that.
It takes a long time.
It does. It's already, most of it's done. But that Machiavelli was wrong. We get power through connecting and being open and cultivating reputation. But watch out, because just when your brain's on power, it does it wreaks all kinds of havoc. So.
It's a drug.
It's a drug. It looks a lot like, cocaine or some of the.
Is it that Machiavelli was wrong, or that Machiavelli was right in certain contexts?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I know. Machiavelli was right in places of violence where there is little trust, where there are single shot interactions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the minute you build up enduring social structures, it tends to.
They say that power, though, actually, at least in terms of how it correlates to status, is a healthy thing. People who won Oscars versus people who came close but didn't win live an average of 4 years longer. They just did a study about that. I thought that was kind of interesting, whether or not that's some statistical mistake or not.
No, they find the same thing for Nobel Prize winners, for all of those sorts of things.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Status is a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think so. How we think about status, and man, you guys are totally, you got it. So, status is different from power, right? Power is how you influence.
Mm-hmm.
Status is really interesting. It's how much people respect you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and wow. Yeah.
What's wonderful about that dynamic is that status is given to you by other people. It is given to you through respect and esteem and social valuing. And there are new neuroscientific studies showing that when I am esteemed by others, right, valued and respected, parts of the brain light up that are associated with the sense of safety.
You relax.
Yeah. So it's one of the most powerful predictors of physical robustness. So it's not a mystery why being esteemed with an Oscar adds to your longevity.
I gotta get back in acting class.
You gotta get an Oscar.
I gotta get some awards at least. I haven't won anything. Last time I won an award, I think it was I won the Outstanding Wrestler Award in high school.
I was
18. Damn it.
Brian, I'm gonna go to Color Me Mine later and I'm gonna make you an award.
Thank you, buddy, for number one podcast.
That's right. Number one human being.
This is when I get so excited, Hunter. Hunter, a long time ago, said, let's start talking to really smart people. Let's just have people who are making a difference in the world, who are asking the big questions. And you're one of those people. So it's just a privilege, man.
It's such a treat.
I get to talk to you. You wouldn't talk to me otherwise. You'd be busy, for Christ's sake. We get you on the podcast. I get to pick your brain.
You guys got me in your first word. So
I love it. I love it. And how long have you been a professor?
So I was 4 years at Madison, Wisconsin, and then 18 years here at Berkeley.
That's great. Why would you leave Berkeley? What a blast.
It's an amazing place.
There was something that I also wanted to ask you about as well, which is sort of the state of nature. You know, I mean, Rousseau and all of those guys, they really didn't know what early human societies were like. We now know. And I was reading a book called Darwin's Cathedral.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they really talk about there is just how egalitarian early societies are, or Stone Age societies are. I mean, you know, the group really polices how much you're sharing and whether you're not sharing, and punishes you if you don't share.
Yep. Yeah. You know, Manhunter, you're reading the right stuff. So that's Christopher Bohm, who has he's an anthropologist, and Joe Henrich up at University of British Columbia are doing these amazing studies. And it's so interesting to think about with respect to how we distribute wealth, right? And one of the things that I'm worried about is the degree of inequality in the United States. And a lot of people are worried about it, right? Robert Reich here at Berkeley and others, because we know it harms people's physical and mental well-being. When you look at hunter-gatherer peoples in radically different circumstances, they share about 40% of their resources just as a default, right? Five fish, I give 40% to Brian. And we are, I do believe that the broad tendency in our evolutionary history is towards egalitarianism. And then you have twists of fate, you have new resources that emerge that allow for radical vertical hierarchies that are problematic with respect to our tendency towards equality, right? And I think a lot of people feel that's happening in the United States. We have a stock market today that pretty much is just benefiting 1% of the country, right?
You know, you're starting to sound like a communist.
Wait a minute. Where are you a professor again?
Wait a minute,
oh,
professor,
my God.
At Berkeley, these left-wing bastards.
Are you wearing Birkenstocks right now?
Isn't it funny, though? It's when you start talking that way, you can see the resistance you probably get from people. Say, wait a minute, hold on, man. I don't care what the science says. This is starting to sound like egalitarian.
Dude. I always get that. But you know, look, here are the data, and this is going to be in my last chapter of the book on power, which is, you know, their new neuroscience data. You know, the U.S. is more unequal. We rank very high by the CIA rankings in terms of our inequality compared to Germany or Scandinavia or certain South American countries, China, whatever. And their data showing when you're raised, holding constant how much you have, if you're raised where there's inequality, it actually activate certain parts of your immune system chronically that hurt your body, right? And
wow.
So lack of resources and inequality is hurting the body. And that's something to, putting aside your political convictions, right? That's just a basic health care.
Well, it goes up back to sharing, right? You should share something, right? I mean, it's not good for you to just hoard everything, right?
But I think the interesting thing too, I mean, when you read this stuff is, you know, Adam Smith, right, brilliantly understood an aspect of human nature, right? Yep. You have all these people who understand these aspects of human nature, and then they, from that one aspect, they then like extrapolate an entire worldview that we buy into because it's hard for us to hold the complexity of a human being in our head.
Right.
And I think what we really need to figure, I mean, there just needs to be so much more cross-pollination between different academic disciplines so that we can start to get a cohesive sense of what is a human being, right? Yes, we pursue our self-interest, but we also need to share. Yeah. And then what does a society building from that really accurate sense of human nature look like?
Yeah, that's a very, you know, forward-thinking observation.
Well, Hunter went to Harvard.
No, but it's really, you know, I mean, as a social scientist, and I do think that this is increasing right now with, you know, people like Dick Thaler and others who have used the social sciences and behavioral economics to guide certain policies. We need to think about what our basic tendencies are. Mm-hmm. And humans actually live longer and are happier if they're giving away more than what our society is allowing us to give away.
But how do you balance that with the idea that most of the innovation comes from this country, and a lot of people would suggest that it's because of the profit motive. It's because you get to benefit from, you know, I mean, when you have high tax rates like in California, the only thing that keeps California afloat, in my opinion, is probably the weather. But, you know, it's a hard place to do business, man. And you want to make sure that people feel safe in knowing that they get to they get a right to their own sweat and labor and the profits therein. So how do we balance that with the idea of, you know, also giving and being responsible? Can't you do that within a free market capitalist context?
You can. And you know, and there are minor adjustments that would, you know, change that. But, you know, I think how we approach it conceptually, Brian, is, and Hunter was alluding to this, and I think Steve Pinker would agree, which is, look, evolution built into us a variety of different instinctual tendencies. The most powerful is self-interest and gratifying desire. A significant part of it is sharing, right? Then you need to build out social structures that, and I think older progressives, you know, and I don't mean to besmirch them, they did so much important work, but they fail to realize like free markets are really good for innovation. They're very good for women in poor countries.
Yeah.
When you give women money, they do better in poor countries. It's one of the universal laws of nonprofit work in developing countries. So we need freedom and capital, obviously, but we need to balance it with these other instinctual tendencies of sharing and communality, if you will.
And I think that's the thing. I think a large part of what we need is we need to define a common goal.
Because, exactly.
And I think that common goal is innovation, you know?
And lowering that major gap
but
between haves and have-nots.
The problem is, I think for a lot of people, when you talk about lowering that gap, why are you lowering that gap? And why are you lowering it as much as you are? Why choose the numbers that you've chosen? It becomes arbitrary. You need
people
to...
Hunter's really right. Like, you know, you start talking about like, oh, changing the tax structure, lowering the gap, they get grouchy. But that's why I like the concept of power. And it's so great to talk to you guys because, you know, if you talk about the unequal distribution in terms of what we really want is empowering everybody, right? And it in California, that would mean poor people should have a shot at a good education, which they don't right now. And that's foundational to the University of California, where we do educate people from very poor backgrounds to great benefit. Empowerment is a good purchase on this problem of redressing inequality.
I think that's the thing. I think what we all need to understand is that we're all better off. I mean, the whole point of democracy, the whole point of capitalism is that the more minds are on a problem, the better and the faster it's going to be solved. And so that I think that ultimately needs to be the goal of our society. And I think that's what's going to allow that sort of bipartisan support is really saying, how do we bring as many people to being actively engaged in the problem? Because guess what? Trust fund kids are not actively trying to solve the problems of the world. And people who are so poor that they can't think in school because they're starving also are not trying to solve problems. And that's a huge waste of human potential at both ends of the scale.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I thank you for your work, man. You do good work, and it's important work. That's for sure. And
thank you so much.
And I'm gonna get into your books. Give us the books again, because we like to promote books on the website and stuff.
So
you make lots of money.
So I'll promote a few things. My first book was Born to Be Good by North. Science of a Meaningful Life. And if you're interested in the evolution of cooperation or touch or compassion or gratitude or awe, it's all there.
Wow.
Then there's the Compassionate Instinct.
The Compassionate Instinct, okay.
And then I would really encourage your listeners to go to, for free, the Greater Good Science Center. And that's greatergood.berkeley.edu. All kinds of great essays, but all by all kinds of great thinkers, from Michael Pollan to Steve Pinker, really thinking about the human condition. And we have a Science of Happiness class that we're launching in the fall, which already has 45,000 people enrolled. It's a big, massive online course that your listeners would love. So
say it one more time. It's Greater Good what? Greater Good?
Greatergood.berkeley.edu.
Okay.
And I'll put that up in, I'll put that in the episode right up.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Well, Dacher, Professor Dacher Keltner, thank you so much for your name, for your work, sir. And you make the world a better place.
And listen, we would love to have you back on when the book comes out.
Anytime you want, man.
That'd be really fun. I really appreciate it.
It's a privilege to talk to you, sir. Thank you so much for your time.
You guys.
All right, man.
All right.
Go back and teach the children. Go change the world, sir.
Yeah.
Peace. Later.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Thanks,
Thank
Hunter.
You.
Talk to you soon.
Great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Awesome, right?
Ah, I love people like that.
Yeah.
I love this podcast. Hunter Motz, thank you. Thanks for getting these guys. Don't stop doing this to me. Please don't get bored.
I won't.
It's so fun.
Yeah, it is.
It's so fun to have a conversation like that to me. It's so fun. Like, how many people get to talk to a guy like that? We just had a great conversation.
That's
two
right.
great conversations. Laid down two podcasts. Do you understand what we're giving you people for free? It's just ideas, smart people. We're expanding your brain. I'm pumped. And if you want to laugh, I'll be doing stand-up somewhere in the country, you fucks.
Or out of the country.
Exactly. I shouldn't say fucks. I keep using the F word. I apologize. Peace!
Brian, you're a smart man now, not a sailor. Not to say that sailors aren't smart, but they do have a tendency towards profanity.
I know, but I'm wearing clogs and bell bottoms.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.